Very good. So, for this morning's talk, more on meditation. And so far, I've been, especially yesterday, talking about the hindrances and also just little by little how they're overcome. This got me. Can you hear okay? And that little by little how they're overcome. And actually how this meditation works. And tying in with what I was saying about Ajahn Chah's teaching, that we meditate to let go of things, not to attain things. And to fill in some of what he meant by that is, years ago, when I was a lay Buddhist, and there was nothing like a meditation retreat center like this. In fact, there's very few places you could do any meditation when I was young. It was in the 60s, 70s. But nevertheless, any place where there was a meditation retreat, I'd always go there. And it didn't matter what tradition, because I figured out that whatever tradition it was, when you had your eyes closed and you were sitting still, the teacher hadn't any clue what was going on in your head. It could be a Vipassana retreat, but I was doing Samatha. It could have been a Zen retreat when I was supposed to be thinking about a koan, but I was just meditating in a normal way. Because that's one great thing about meditation. When your eyes close, no one knows what's going on inside your head. And don't ever think that, oh, okay, some monks or some nuns can read your mind. Quite honestly, as I often say, to put you at your ease, most people's minds aren't ready to read. And if you just take a peek in it, oh no, crikey. You'd be like looking at a bad book. So you don't have to worry, no one's going to read your mind. It's not worth it. And also, anyway, if say a monk did read your mind or a nun read your mind, you can always deny it. Plausible denial, because how can I prove that you know what you were really thinking about a few moments ago? And that was that was a little trick, which actually is supposed to have happened in the royal court in Thailand, no, a couple of hundred years ago, 300 years ago or something. Because, you know, like in a royal court, it was that's the government, and they'd always try and get these people who are super intelligent, super smart. But every now and again, there's some people who are too intelligent, too smart. I mean, they really, really upset other people. And so there was one of these ministers in the court, and he was just a big know-it-all. You know, everything he knew better than everybody else. The problem was, it was often true. And so that got all the other ministers and courtiers really upset. And so, of course, what happened? They hatched a plan. They met together and they said, how can we get rid of this guy? He's just, you know, so arrogant, just, you know, so just full of himself. So we got to somehow embarrass him in front of His Majesty. And they came up with this plan. They said, they planned that we would just start praising him, saying what a wonderful person he is, how loyal, how patriotic, how good, and just get him into a false sense of super arrogance. And then once he'd been praised a lot, they were going to say to him in front of the Majesty, said, you are so wise and clever. You probably know what each one of us is thinking. You can probably read our minds. And he'd probably say yes. And then the plan is, even if he does know what we're thinking, we'll deny it, because how can you prove that what you're thinking, you know, is what he says you're thinking? So that was the plan, to embarrass him in front of His Majesty. So the following morning they met, and they said to His Majesty, oh, you're so fortunate, Your Majesty, that you've got such a wise minister, you know, over there. He said, yeah, that's me. And then he said, you are so smart. Oh, thank you, at last you realise that. You know everything, of course. You probably even know what we're thinking. Hey, of course. Got ya. So he said, well, could you please tell His Majesty what we're all thinking right now? And whatever he said, you're thinking about how to solve the economy. Even if they were thinking that, the minister said, no, that's not what I was thinking. I was thinking of lunch or something. And so he was caught and said, I know what you're all thinking. And he said, each one of you ministers and courtiers in front of His Majesty, you're all thinking kind thoughts towards His Majesty. And the minister said, yeah, sure, right. So if you want proof that I can read your minds, you're all thinking kind thoughts towards the monks and nuns. Because even if you weren't, you might as well say yes. So anyway, so where was I going with this one? Oh yeah. I just remember the jokes, so I don't remember what I was supposed to be saying. I'm talking about meditation somewhere. And, sorry?
Reading minds.
Yeah, well, reading your own mind is probably the best to actually find out what's going on. But anyway, as you, yesterday when you were talking about just how to understand your mind, how to calm it down, because get rid of the five hindrances so you can actually get some clarity. Reading your own mind is more important than reading other people's, getting to know, you know, what you're up to and how you work. So little by little in your meditation, we've learned this, how to be aware of our body and how to relax it, which is a wonderful thing to be able to do for health reasons, if for nothing else. It's one of those side benefits which happen when we meditate, that we can just, you know, learn, you know, obviously within limitations of our karma and our bodies, but we can learn exactly how our body works and learn how to relax it and deal with it. And so some wonderful, wonderful ways. But what that does, you start to learn this wonderful combination of mindfulness together with kindness or letting go. Sometimes people say, well, I don't really understand kindness. I say, well, do letting go. I don't really understand letting go. Well, be kind. Because those two come together. And the best way of describing how those two merge together, just the letting go or letting be and being kind, is that story, you know, from my father about the opening the door of your heart. Because when he took me aside when I was about 13 or 14, oh yeah, I was going to meditation retreat with different traditions. But anyway, my father took me aside one day and said, now I've lost this track now. I've got two tracks at the same time. Silly gadget pal. He said to me, he was a poor man because he's always very sick. And so he said to me one day that wherever you go in your life, whatever you do, however you turn out, know, just good, someone which parents will be proud to be the parents of, or whether you turn out to be notorious and bad, and most people will be embarrassed to say that, you know, that's my son. It doesn't matter, whoever you are, however you turn out, I want you to always keep in mind the door of my house will always be open to you. I remember saying that. I must have been at 13 or 14 at the time. And it was said in a way that I remembered it, but I didn't understand it. You know that sometimes people say something, you know it's important, and you know, put it there in your memory somewhere to be really contemplated later on. Very important words. And then I sort of, when I was a monk, really started to contemplate it, what my father said. He was dead by that time. And I realized it couldn't be his house, because his house was too poor. In fact, you know, often it wasn't locked. It wasn't locked, you know, just because we trusted all the neighbours. It wasn't kept open because we trusted all our neighbours. It was kept open because my father said he was actually hopeful that a burglar might come in, take pity on us, and leave us something. They were poor. And anyway, so it wasn't a house. And I realised, you know, just change the word to his heart, and that's what he really meant. Well, however you turn out, wherever you go, whatever happens, you're my son, I'm your father, the door of my heart will always be open to you. You'll never be rejected. Because, you know, the father-son relationship, the bond, was much greater than anything which the world will say about us. And that just really opened up what I now understand as loving kindness. Non-judgmental, mindfulness, giving, caring. And that was a beautiful thing to know that you had that from your father, and that my job now is to spread that to other people, especially to myself. To say to myself, Ajahn Brahm, despite all those ridiculous, stupid jokes, which you say again and again and again, the door of my heart's open to me. And you can imagine a heart opening up and you coming in. And it just reminds me of just some of those little stories, just how incredibly powerful they can be, much more than I ever expected. Because I'll tell this story of a group called ASSETS, the Australian Society of Survivors of Torture and Trauma. And one of the workers there, they invited me to their offices in East Perth, I think it was. And I didn't know why they invited me there until they described that a couple of the stories, but in particular the opening the door of your heart story, was highly effective. Highly effective for what? It's actually dealing with people who had migrated to Australia, you know, from some of the worst situations you could imagine. People who had been multiple raped, tortured in these underground prisons, and somehow or other they had survived. Somehow they'd physically survive this horrendous treatment. And I say this, but sometimes when you hear, you know, from the people who experienced it, the sorts of things which one human being can do to another, it's just mind-boggling. And you say, how can anyone do that? It happened day after day after day. But they somehow, they survived, endured, and now they've come to Australia. Physically they were free, but emotionally they were still in those underground cells being abused. And the job of these psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists was to somehow free their minds as well as their bodies. And I was just so touched that one of the main stories they were using was this, the door of my heart is open to you. And they explained how they used it. And I did describe it years ago in one of my talks about how you can actually practice opening the door of your heart. So when you, first of all, you have to feel in a safe, comfortable place. Sometimes it takes a long time to get that feeling that, you know, you've got half an hour for yourself and no one's going to interrupt you and you're perfectly cocooned against any harm. And then you imagine, you do your visualizations of the heart in your chest. Not a medical heart, because, you know, you've seen real hearts, you know, and they're just, you know, really a blob with all these tubes going all over the place called arteries and veins and stuff. And, you know, it's not easy to imagine the real heart. So the usual Valentine's Day heart, pointed at the bottom with a little cleavage in the top. Nice and simple. Okay, not real, but it doesn't have to be real to be an image which can work. So you imagine this Valentine's Day heart, right in the centre of your chest. I know the heart's a little bit to the left, but in the centre. So I know I have to say this because sometimes, you know, in the middle of my anecdote and somebody spoils it, I say, Ajahn Brahm, that's not what a heart looks like. It's not there, it's this way. It's like, well, you know, come on. But anyway, so imagine the heart in the centre of your chest, the Valentine's Day heart. And then you Imagine, you visualize two doors opening, just like the two doors here, the two doors there, opening up. And there inside your heart is you. This girl, this boy, this person, you know, who you are used to and you're comfortable with. The one which you can embrace and live with. But that's not all of you. Because you look down outside, rejected, alone, out there on the cold, hard concrete outside. It's those little yous who are so badly abused, so badly harmed, so badly just your screams and cries went unheard, rejected, alone, outside. You're inside, warm, comfortable. They're outside, cold, alone, afraid. And then you imagine just these stairs coming down from your heart, going down to the ground. And there, that part of you which you can accept, the part of you which you can live with easily, looks down at those parts of you which are being pushed outside because it's so hard to take. And you look at those little parts of you, all those many beings who were abused and hurt, and you say, come in, come up. And you visualize all these little yous which have been so badly hurt for no reason. Can't understand why that happened and who would do such a thing, but it happened. And you imagine them coming up, needing so much encouragement for that part of you inside your heart already. So afraid, so trembling, come in. And you invite them into your heart, embracing pain, but now they're inside. Rather than being outside, each one of them, bring them in. And you find when you open the door of your heart, even to the painful, almost intolerable little beings that were you, come in. You find there is a catharsis, a sense of peace. It's not denying that those things happened. You'll always feel them. But they're inside now, rather than rejected. And I was just stunned by how well that works. I've never been really tortured or traumatized that much in my life. But each one of us have had our real difficulties, but these are people who are just way up there with what happened to them, or down there, whichever way you look at it. And they said, that worked more than anything else. It was part of me, and for years I've been trying to deny it, trying to push it out, trying to go to a place where those memories just can't reach me. But they always do. And to have the courage, the strength to say, come in, instead of get out, was one of the key things which reconciled themselves to their past. I still remember one of those was a middle-aged woman, elderly woman. She was at Anolamara Center one evening. And, you know, she'd been through worse than hell. And she was talking to this young man, I think, from one of the Kalyana Mitta groups. Which used to be a youth group. Now it's everybody goes to this Kalyana Mitta group. Fair enough. But anyway, that he said, to her. He said, that was terrible what you went through. And he said it with, you know, with some sympathy. But then she shot back at him. He said, what do you mean that was terrible? That's who I am. That's me. That's part of me. I've reconciled with that a long time ago. And it really shook me to see just what she had done with that terrible, terrible stuff which you had endured. And so the opening the door of your heart can be incredibly powerful. And it was getting people to live their life not having got rid of the trauma, but to live life with, embracing who they were. And it was not a pain anymore. It was amazing. Those people were just heroes, saints. But anyway, the opening of the door of your heart is, you know, one of the most important parts of letting go. You don't fight, you let it be. Intolerable, you think. It's only intolerable when you try to push it out. When you let it be, embrace. It's called loving kindness. Otherwise, called letting be. The difference between letting go and letting be is letting go is letting go of controlling, trying to get rid of, trying to change, trying to manipulate, trying to do something with it. Letting be is the result. So you just let whatever's here be. You let the trauma, the memory of it. It's not sort of acknowledging, saying that it's okay to traumatize people, to treat people badly. That's not what we're saying. It's for the persons on the receiving end of that, how they can deal with it. Making sure it doesn't happen again is another task. But to be able to open the door of your heart to what's happening, let it be, have kindness. Kindness is not just allowing bad behavior to continue. It's the recipient learning just how. If there's nothing you can change, nothing you can do, then leave it alone and see what happens next. Great change happens. So the letting be is, you have a pain in your chest or in your leg. This is for you. Sometimes unbearable. Instead of fighting it, I open the door of my heart to that pain in the knee. What happens is something unexpected. If you're doing this to try and get rid of the pain, that's not letting go, that's not letting be. That's another form of manipulation and will and trying to change things. It's the old story of the person who said, okay, come on, let it be, let it be, let it be. How many times do I have to tell you? Let it be. And so our mind is just complicated that way, because we do letting go, letting be, open the door of your heart just as a trick, just as a means to reach our ends. And that's not the point. We don't have any ends. We don't have any goals. We just let it be as it is and see what happens. So that's one of the reasons why I ask people to, when you are focusing on your body, if you have an ache or a pain somewhere, just zoom in on it and then just open the door of your heart to it. Let it be. It doesn't matter whether it's, my father said, no matter how you turn out, a really criminal, bad fellow, or sort of a really wonderful person, which I would be very proud to be the father of, no matter what it is, you're in. That acceptance, that embracing, that letting be, that open the door of your heart, that kindness. So I always look as kindness, compassion, as just another way of saying the same thing. Called let it be. Let go of discrimination. Let go of judgment. Let go of pushing out things which you don't like and trying to gain and control and own things which you do like. Let it be. And so when you do stuff like that, you find that the pain, the ache, the tension vanishes. It eases off. If it's a memory of the past, that eases off too. Which is one of the reasons when people ask me sometimes, they ask me already one of the questions, how do you let go of the past and let go of the future? And I gave the simile of the shopping bags, but there's something more as well which helps you let go of the past and let go of the future. And that is developing kindness to the past, developing compassion for the future. And so sometimes people have a hard enough time being kind to like a cat or to be, you know, to their child sometimes. But, you know, you can understand to a being being compassionate and kind to that. But how can you be compassionate and kind to an inanimate object? Or being kind to something like your past? What it means, you look at all your past with all your history, you know, the good and the bad, and you give it compassion. I don't know why that person hurt me so, but I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt, the kindness, almost like the forgiveness. You know, all the stupid things which I have done. I did actually say I should tell more, the stupid things which I have done. Do you think that I was a saint when I was born? Do you think that I was a really wonderful kid? And the answer is absolutely not. One of the most stupidest things which I ever did when I was about 7 or 8 years of age was on my mother's birthday. Some people know what I'm going to come up with. And I was 7 or 8 years of age. My mother's birthday, and I thought, I'm going to get her a surprise birthday present. I had the little shoebox and this little gift paper and even a ribbon and a little card, happy birthday. And what I put in the box was quite surprising for you, because at that time in London, there was a food craze, it only lasted about a year, which was mashed potatoes together with jellied eels. You know, like long eels like this, and just out of the water, they boil them, put them in some jelly or something, I'm not sure how it worked, and that was like a food craze. And so, just not far from the flats where my mother lived, there was a pie and eel shop. They always had meat pies as well. Pie and eels, or mash and eels. So I went to the shop, this little 7 or 8 year old kid, and said, can I have an eel, please, mister? And that's what we used to call him, mister. Hey, mister, can I have an eel, please? And I wanted a live one, which they sometimes they sold, so you can take them home and cook them fresh. So a live eel, please. And so they gave me an eel. They wrapped it in a piece of newspaper, and they're still wriggling. And I quickly put it in the box, and then I wrapped up the box, you know, with as beautiful, as careful as a 7-year-old could wrap up a box, you know, with nice little sticky tape, and I even tied a ribbon. And then I put a little card on there to Mummy, happy birthday, love your son. No, Peter, my name wasn't, XXX. And then I don't know how I managed to pull this off without laughing. But I just, a cute little 7-year-old going off to your mummy and just big eyes saying, Mummy, happy birthday. Ah, it's so sweet. You can almost see just tears start to well in my mother's eyes. Oh, just he thought of this all by himself. How cute. I wonder what it is inside. Open it up, Mummy. And she undid the bow and the little ribbon around the box, and she took off the paper, and she opened the lid, and you could not have trained that eel to do it better. The eel, as soon as it opened up the box, raised its head and looked at my mum. Ah! She screamed so loud. But I was quite a smart kid. I had my, what they call these days, my exit strategy. I planned my route, how I was going to run, and I ran really hard. I hid for 2 hours before my mother recovered. Oh, I'm such a wonderful boy. You can see my kindness was there from the very beginning. Oh, how you treat your mothers. Well, it's out of my, but anyway, she forgave me. How she did that. Oh, boy. Anyway, your past. So when you have kindness towards your past, yeah, it was a stupid thing I did. I was a little boy, didn't know. I thought it was good fun at the time. That poor old eel, though, I asked my mother, a couple of hours later, what she did with it. And she sort of, she put it in the toilet and just flushed it down into the sewers. So I'm sure the eel was happy ever after. Anyway, as for the remembering the past, you did some good things and bad things. Hard things happen to you, good things happen to you. But when you look at the past with kindness, you open the door of your heart to it, it actually softens it. It makes it much easier to let it go when you've been kind to the past. Kind to yourself. I'm only a 7-year-old boy. I didn't have any bad will towards my mother. I wasn't trying to give her a heart attack to get rid of her. You loved your mum to bits, and it was just a bit of fun and a bit of joy, and maybe she didn't think that, but the whole point was that it was, when you're kind to the past, you soften it. It makes it so much easier to let go. When you're hard to the past, that person, what they did to me, that son of mine, you can see just anger is very hard and harsh and spiky. It scratches you. And if you can just, as it were, the spikes, you sort of file them down so they're not sharp anymore. With kindness, you round their edges. And then it's very easy to let go of the past. I'm stupid, did really smart things, some wonderful things, and some stupid things. And little by little, you can let go of the past once you've been kind to it. And as for the future as well, be kind to your future. What do you mean by that? Why is it always we look upon the future and always look at the bad stuff which is going to happen? The really awful stuff which is going to happen. We look upon the future with a negative attitude. And that's called anxiety, fear. But instead we look upon the future with kindness. Well, if something does happen, if I step in the dog poo, that's just more fertilizer for my mango tree, as my old simile goes. But there was an extension to that. This man, he was just walking down New York Street and he stepped in a big pile of dog poop. And he got it all over his shoes. And he looked at his shoes. And then a few moments later, this big, I don't know why I always say bikies, this big bikey fellow, sort of, he was walking down the street. He also stepped in that dog poo. And the first man said, "Oh, I just did that." Bang. Okay, she got it. A few people are getting it in the back. And the guy said, "I just did that." Which means it didn't, the bikey thought it didn't mean that he just stepped in it, that he just deposited it. Oh boy. Anyway, so you look upon the future and, whatever happens, it's fine. With a bit of kindness. So open the door of your heart to whatever happens in the future. Open the door of the heart to whatever happened in the past. The door of my heart's open to you. Future, wherever it leads me. That makes it very easy not to be anxious and to let things be. That's one way, but anyway, going back to the other part of the other thread of this talk. When I was a young monk and going to other monasteries, and I went to this Zen monastery once, because it's the only place which had a retreat at the time. And so I went, and there was a weekend retreat, and Zen, Rinzai, the guy, the master, came with a stick. Early in the morning, we were meditating, and you walked. You had your back towards the teacher. You were facing the wall, and you walked past you. And I never got hit by that Zen stick, because what happened was there was a meditator sitting next to me, and he was more sleepy than I was. I always had good karma that way, and so he got hit with a Zen stick. Whack. And as soon as he got sick, All my sloth and torpor have already gone. It was totally abolished for the rest of the retreat, out of fear. So that was the other antidote to sloth and torpor. If it hasn't worked yet, you're still sleepy, with all the advice I've given you, we could always get Venerable Nisarano to help with a Zen stick and to go, I'll get rid of your sloth and torpor. But unfortunately, you can't do that these days, because when I was in Hong Kong a few years ago, Hong Kong is just in this monastery like a melting pot of so many different traditions and different monks. And there was one monk there from mainland China. We were sitting around having a cup of tea, doing what everybody else does if they're in a coffee shop, only we were doing it in a monastery, gossiping and talking about what's happening here. Well, have you heard about this? And monks, not that different than ordinary people, maybe sometimes. But anyway. And this guy, this monk, he said, oh yeah, he was on this retreat in mainland China. And there was the Zen monk came with a stick. And this is a middle-aged lady. She was really sleepy. So he whacked her on the back with a Zen stick. And she was really shocked. So she reached in her bag, got out her cell phone, and called the police. And the police came 10 minutes later and arrested that monk and took him away. You can't do that in the modern world. It was assault. He had no defense. So be careful if you ever try to use a Zen stick in Australia or wherever you come from, you get jail for that. Okay, but anyway, so that wasn't the reason I was telling about this particular monastery, because we were asked to keep our eyes open when we were meditating. So that was with my eyes open, watching this whitewashed wall. It was an old barn converted to be a zendo, a meditation hall. I was sitting there just watching this whitewashed wall. Now, it worked for me because I'd already done enough meditation before. I could make my mind in the present moment and not thinking, just being, and just looking at a whitewashed wall. And then, the reason I say this, it was weird, the wall disappeared. It vanished. It wasn't there anymore. And that was really cool. I wasn't afraid, because these were the years that my mates were taking drugs and stuff. Anything weird was interesting. Remember, I also, beforehand, was going around looking for ghosts with my mate, Professor Bernard Carr. And so I was always interested, not afraid. And so when the wall disappeared, instead of going, ah! It was like, wow, this is cool, this is interesting. How come a wall was there and now it's no longer there? It's not blackness, it hasn't changed colour, it's just nothing there. And then, of course, you started to investigate, explore, the bottle of water. What's going on here? No one's taught me this before. And then you just realise it's so easy to understand. If you close your eyelids, you see the inside of your eyelids, first of all, for maybe 10 seconds, maybe less, maybe more. But after a while, you don't see that anymore. Sense of sight turns off. Because ask any sort of neuroscientist that your eyes, sense of sight, and the brain, part of that sense of sight, is only made to notice things which change. If nothing changes, that sense turns off. So similar these days to your computer or your iPhone or whatever you use, is if you don't press anything after a while, the screen turns off. It's the efficiency of the brain. So if you just watch a whitewashed wall, focusing on it, not thinking, not daydreaming, after a while, the brain feels there's nothing going on here. So it just clicks off the sense of sight. Sound, if there is a hum in the background, could be the air conditioner, could be the traffic in the distance. After a while, you don't hear the sound. It turns off. It's called the background sound, the ambient noise. If you are body is reasonably comfortable and you no shooting pains, after a while, you know, your body may feel hot, may have pressure on it. After a while, the body disappears. Nothing's happening. The brain turns off the sense of feeling. If you are sitting there, there's, you know, there's no, people don't use scent here, there's no incense. The sense of smell is so easy to turn off, unless someone's eaten too many baked beans this morning. But if you do have problem with wind, please, out of compassion for other people, make sure you're sitting in the back against the wall. Please never sit in the front, because then if you do pass wind, there's so many other people behind you who will have to suffer the smells. So now you all know why the people sitting in the back are so located. No, but it's just, as long as there's no change of smell, then sense of smell turns off. And then same as is the taste of your saliva. After a while, it just disappears because nothing is changing. When nothing changes, things disappear. And that's a really important thing to understand about how meditation works. It's why we keep still, why we sit still, why we close our eyes, or we try not to make too many noises. Because when you're still, things disappear. So you sit here, close your eyes, present moment, not going past, future, future, past, present. Stay in the present moment. After a while, time disappears. It's not there anymore. Makes no sense. It just doesn't exist for you at this moment. And the calm down the thoughts in the silence, and then you feel, you close your eyes, sight vanishes, smells and tastes easy to allow to cease. It's only temporarily, but that's all you need for the now. The two big ones are the sense of the sound and the feelings in the body. And the sound, even if you don't pay any attention to it, after a while it vanishes. No sound. And your body. So you're sitting comfortably, not moving. And after a while, much of the body disappears. There's nothing going on there. It turns off. But there's one part of you, one part of your body, has to keep moving. And that's usually that's much more noisy than your heart. So a lot of times when the rest of the body vanishes, it's comfortable, it's not causing a problem, so it just shuts, the sense perceptions of that part of the body just shut down, and you're left with the breathing. I always wondered why it was that the Buddha kept on emphasizing breath meditation. Why? Until afterwards you realize that that's what happens naturally. When everything is calm and peaceful, when things become still, they disappear. So the rest of the body is comfortable, it just vanishes, it disappears, and the thing which is left is your breathing. Literally, the breathing is all that's left to watch. Breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. When you let go, you let things be, you're kind, things become no problem. They vanish, they disappear. This is the wonderful thing about meditation. From stillness, it leads to disappearance. And disappearance, things open up and see what's actually inside. The outer shells, the outer casings, start to disappear. So you're there with your breath. You don't choose to watch it, it's just there. It's the only thing to watch now. Very similar to the anecdote of the flotation chambers. I won't go through the full anecdote, but then if you ever go into a flotation chamber, they're soundproof. You float in salt water, so you know there's no pressure on your body at all. So And because you're floating in salt water about the same density as your body, it just, no pressure on any part of the body. It's at your body temperature, so you can't actually even feel the water there. Floating in it, it's soundproof, it's dark, lightproof. Obviously they have to have some oxygen going in and going out. But it's your senses have got nothing to do. But apparently that people who go in those sensory deprivation chambers, they don't see anything, they don't hear any sounds from outside or feel any pressure on their body. But what really is emphasized in those flotation chambers is now your breath. I remember Ajahn Chakra going in one and he said, yeah, it was amazing, just everything else was quiet, but because everything else was removed, his breath was really loud. It's just the ordinary breath, but there's nothing else to compete with it. And that's what happens in meditation. You just have your breath, it's the only thing which is left. So you just with the breath in the moment, just breathing in, breathing out. And, you know, sometimes people say, well, isn't that boring? Oh, come on, don't you want a bit of a rest and a relaxation? Don't spoil it. And apparently in many of those relaxation chambers now, because they don't know what to do with their breathing, they tend to actually have to have videos in there, like golf videos to improve your swing. Or something to do, because, you know, people get bored, you know, if they don't know how to use these sensory deprivation chambers. But anyway, and here you're with your body, watching your breath. And you find out, because you're just watching the breath, you're not thinking, you're not writing an essay about it, you're reasonably still. And what happens is you don't need so much fuel, so much oxygen, because you're not doing very much. And the body and the brain doesn't need to take in so much oxygen. So your breath gets lighter, smoother. Don't need so much oxygen. And so because your breath gets smoother and lighter, it gets more peaceful. Now, the next anecdote to show what happens next, naturally. Remember, you don't do anything here, this is what happens. A natural turning off of your sensory apparatus just because you are still. Then, years ago, first coming here, and 7 years up and down that hillside in a car, 3 or 4 times a week, 2 or 3 times a week, whatever. And then one day I asked my driver, please let me out, I want to walk up the hill. And so I went out and walked up the hillside. It was this beautiful morning, not too hot, not too cold, nice and sunshine. And it was a shock to me, because this was the first time I'd walked up the hillside in 7 years of living up here. And I could not recognize that hillside of Kingsbury Drive. Totally different than anything I expected or remembered. And that was again another shock. Why does it look different? More beautiful. And it stunned me, so I stopped and stared. And when I stopped and stared, it looked even more beautiful. And trying to figure out what was going on again, exploring these experiences rather than being afraid of them, that it was, again, obvious. When you look through a window of a speeding car, not speeding that much, maybe 40 kilometers an hour, 50 kilometers an hour, it's up a steep hill. When you look through the window, the light which hits the back of your eye, the retina, it forms an image on it. It's a chemical reaction. And that when I was looking through the window of a speeding car, one image would not fully form yet, and then another image would displace it, and then another image, and then another image, then another image. No image was ever fully formed before the next one came up. So I could never see any detail. And even the colors didn't have a chance to fully form. But when I got out of the car and walked, the light hit the back of the eye, the same scene had more chance to form a picture with more detail and richer color But when I actually just stopped and stood still and stared, that was when I gave my visual apparatus all the time it needed to make a full picture without being disturbed with another one coming. And so I saw so much more detail, and so much, the colours were far richer. What was happening was I was realising that in my life, rushing around here, rushing around there, I thought I knew people, I thought I knew the road in which I lived, I thought I knew so much, but I only saw a fraction of it, because the images in my eye, in my ears, my mind trying to figure out what was going on, feelings in the body, the taste of your lunch, you don't fully taste it, because you're going too fast. You can just stop and allow the experience of taste to fully form and for you to explore it. It's so much more rich, so much more delightful. I've never seen that hillside so beautiful since that time, or rather before, when you stopped and stared. It's like the beauty was there, but been washed out, diluted, never fully formed, because I was going too fast. That is what happens with your breathing. You haven't been paying too much attention to it in your life, and even in meditation, still going too fast. When you slow down more, you see more, you feel more, become so much more sensitive. And the weird thing is, what you're sensitive of, what you see is more delightful than you expect. So what happens is then the breath becomes delightful. It's just how the mind sees it, because you're slowing down. Just breathing in, breathing out, natural. Similar to when you're doing walking meditation. Sometimes you're doing walking meditation, this is weird, I'm just walking, but it feels so much feelings and sensation in your feet as you lift it up. Millions of sensations. Boring. You can just do this for hours. Sometimes you feeling all the different feelings and sensations as you move your leg up through the air and move it forward. So this is where you get the joy and delight, which happens naturally. You don't say, right, I've done the breath, now I'm going to do the delightful breath. It happens just without you worrying about it. That's why all these stages of meditation is not what you achieve, it's just what happens, more like landmarks on the journey, so you get some idea of where you are, but not what you aspire to. So there you go, you're just watching the breath and become so delightful. When it gets delightful, or when you're walking meditation, just a delightful step. There was, my classic story was, first year in Thailand, I was in a busy monastery in Bangkok. And every morning I'd do my 1 hour walking meditation. I knew it was 1 hour because I don't know why they do this, had a big grandfather clock chiming the quarter hours. It's supposed to be a meditation hall, but imagine that. You're just about to get into jhana, ding dong, ding dong, dong ding, ding dong. But I was doing my walking meditations, that didn't matter. So, and I could time myself without forcing it. It was about half an hour to walk from one end to the other and half an hour to walk back again. And what happened was I'd only got about three quarters of the way through, and then I was just watching on the floor, just nice and peaceful, just amazed at just all the different sensations when just one foot moves up. You can feel everything, just almost like a dancer feels all the muscles move as you do your step. And then I heard this sound, like 100 miles away. I only could just perceive it. Brahma Wang So. Brahma Wang So. It was weird. Was this a ghost or some heavenly being or something? And then, of course, I took my attention, my mindfulness away from my feet. And I realized it was a monk shouting right into my ear. No exaggeration, because I was just so inside my walking meditation. And what had happened was that I was late to an appointment and he'd been sent to come and get me. And there he was, Brahma Wangso! That's what he was saying, and I was saying, Brahma Wangso. And I realized, a very junior monk, so I better sort of come out of my meditation. But it was so hard, you know, because you know, I had to go, this is how we train socially, to talk to someone, you look at them. So I was looking at the floor, and I realized I had to look over there. It's amazing, just the muscles which move in your neck. And what you have to do, actually, to move those muscles, it's so many feelings, sensations there. And it took me about 3 or 4 minutes to actually to turn, I'm really speeding up, to turn around and look at this monk. What? You know, to actually to crank up your brain to start moving again, which is so difficult. It didn't want to, it's just so happy just being in this beautiful little space of just doing your walking meditation. So that's actually sometimes what it's like. Walking meditation or sitting meditation, you're sitting there, delightful breath, having a great time. And so, no, I don't want to come out. So breathing in, breathing out, peace. And people say, oh, you're getting attached to that? Great, that's a good thing to get attached to. Delightful breath. Or just walking nice and peaceful. But I know sometimes people say attachment is bad. Don't be attached. You're attached bad. But I always say, if you're in, say, Bangkok, going down Sukhumvit Road on the back of a motorbike, please be attached. There are times when attachment is good. And when you're having a beautiful, peaceful meditation, just stay there. And then you have this, you realize how delightful meditation can be. And that was a wonderful realization. You could have a religious path, a spiritual path, which you know, led to the ultimate, and it was happiness upon happiness upon happiness. It just started there with a beautiful breath and the delight in walking meditation, delight in solitude, just being in your own little shell. And it started building up more and more. You started realizing all these senses, they're just so irritating. What you take to be just your world, when you just leave it for a little while and go into a delightful breath, you can't hear anything, body you can't feel except your delightful breath, no smell, no taste, no sights, just got your beautiful breath. Really simple. Your senses are disappearing. The less you have to attend to these five senses, the more joy you have. These senses, they suck so much of your energy and concern. You have to do things, like, you know, to eat and wash, but then there are times that we just sit and get all the joy and happiness we could ever have. And this is only the start. Episode 2 of The Delightful Breath will be coming tomorrow. In a meditation hall close to you. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. And somebody told me that it's somebody's birthday today. So, let go of the past, Burley. Let go of the future. And what have you left with? The present. So that's your birthday gift. Okay, very good. I'm not going to give you a parcel with nice... you might find an eel inside. Okay, so now...
Next birthday after that.
Oh, I know, this is very careful. Now, you're going to get away with that once. I didn't push my luck too much. Okay, so now some interviews for those who want interviews. I'll carry on meditating and see if we can get to a delightful breath.
That's great.
You know, the